We start this evening with sad news from the world of music. Acclaimed singer-songwriter Cathal Coughlan has died at the age of 61. Known to a generation of music fans in Ireland as the singer, songwriter and artistic driver of Cork band Micro Disney, along with Sean O'Hagan, Cathal Coughlan went on to found the equally lauded group Fatima Mansions in March 2021. Cathal's solo album, Songs of Coach Clan, was very well reviewed here in Arena, and earlier this year he teamed up with Irish composer and producer Garrett Jackknife Lee in another collaboration called Telefiche, equally well received. Brian Boyd has been taking a look once again at the career of Cathal Coughlan, and he joins me now. Very sad news this, Brian, to get today. How significant a figure would you say Cathal Coughlan was in Irish music?
Hugely significant, Sean. He wouldn't have been as well known as the likes of Van Morrison and Phil Lynott, but in his own way, he was very much a pioneer. He was coming from, he was like forged in the white heat of punk rock music in Cork in the late 70s, but he very much connected with the European tradition, was very influenced by Brachtan Vile, and really escaped those punk rock roots and became more of a European tradition musician, and was very eclectic and was very confrontational and never boring. That's the most important thing about Cathal, never boring.
Yeah, and while he may not have had commercial success, it was that eclecticism, it was that uncompromising attitude of his and that artistry of his that really was his hallmark.
It was a sense of humour with it too. Like, for example, when Micro Disney moved to London and got their first record label deal, they called one of their albums, and remember, this would have been the early 80s during the South African apartheid era, they called the album We Hate You, South African Bastards. And then when they got their really big deal on with Virgin Records, and this was supposed to bring them into the top 10, one of the first songs they released on Virgin was a song, their best song, called A Singer's Hampstead Home, which was a scabrous attack on Virgin's then big seller, Boy George. So Cathal was always of the sense that he didn't belong in the music industry, the entertainment industry. He saw himself as belonging to a more of a deeper artistic tradition, and really never compromised, but he never po-faced about it. There was a lot of humour with it too. And he had a great sense. He was very, very similar to, I was just thinking today, how similar he was to another late great Irish musician, Phil Chevron from the Radiators and the Pogues. And they both came from the punk tradition, but both really connected with that European, in the same sense as Gavin Friday, in that they were very influenced by Brecht and Vile, and they wanted to move more into musical theatre, which Cathal and Phil eventually did.
Yeah, and certainly in both the album Songs of Coach Clan, which itself is a humorous take on Coughlan's own name and how it would have been mispronounced by many, I suppose, predominantly American people, and Telefiche, the more recent album, the same type of thing, kind of has a look at Irish society with a St. Bridget's cross on the front of the album, bringing us back to the early days of RTE, and it brings us through all of that with great humour, great irony.
That's the thing about him, Sean. He was always looking back at his Irish history in a very sort of mordant way. For example, one of his best works of the last 10 years. I remember when he left Micro Disney and Fatima Mansions, he had so many solo collaborations. I met him once and he was telling me he'd just come back from singing with a 15-piece orchestra in Paris. He was a huge cult figure in Paris. Yeah. This is one of the things people don't realise. Maybe not so well known in his home country, but in France, in certain music circles, he was seen as a great visionary, as a great iconoclast. And one of his last great works was the North Sea Scrolls. And the whole conceit here was that he had found these ancient North Sea Scrolls, which totally rewrote the history between Ireland and Britain. And he did there was a concept album and then a stage play come musical tour set about this. So always interesting, always fascinating in his own way. And as you were saying, the Telefiche thing, even though it was a sort of an Irish version of sci-fi electro-funk, it still harked back to the 70s in Ireland. Yeah. And that was a lot of Cathal's work went back to those days. And a brilliant connecting of the dots.
Yeah, his legacy, just as we go into something from the 70s and Town to Town from Micro Disney, what do you think Cathal Coughlan's legacy will be, Brian?
Huge. I think the more Irish artists will connect with him over the years. He's one of these artists that, although he never sold that many records during his career, he will be one of these artists whose reputation and his critical importance only grows over the years. Yeah. And you will see, I predict in 10, 15, 20 years time down in Cork, there will be a symposium on about Cathal Coughlan's life and times and his music. He was that important. The music was fantastic. He was great fun. Very controversial, always left the punters with a smile on their face.
And this song will definitely leave you with a smile on your face. Thanks for that. That's Brian Boyd paying tribute to the singer-songwriter Cathal Coughlan, died today at the age of 61. And to put a smile on your face from Micro Disney days, here is Town to Town. Yes, indeed, remembering the wonderful Cathal Coughlan there and Town to Town from Micro Disney, bringing us to 12 minutes past 7. The Magdalen Series is a programme of exhibitions and events curated by the Rua Red Gallery in Talla. For the series, the gallery commissioned 5 artists to research and produce new work in response to the figure of Mary Magdalen. The series of works continues with the launch this Friday of The Tower by Dublin artist Jessie Jones. And Jessie is with me in studio this evening. She's an incredibly interesting figure, Mary Magdalen. There are so many sides to her and so many attitudes to her. When you got this commission, Jessie, what were you coming with? What were your preconceptions, if you like, of Mary Magdalen?
I suppose she's a very loaded figure. So there, you know, the preconceptions are like, you know, it hits you in the face, the legacies of the Magdalen laundries in this country, and how that the name of that figure was so associated with women's incarceration and oppression in this country. But that became a jumping off point. And what I was really drawn to was I was reading a writer called Megan Waterson, and she wrote this book that kind of called The Magdalen Revealed. And she tries to rehabilitate Mary Magdalen. And one of the things that she says is, if we actually take the word Magda and the name, and we begin with her name, the Aramaic for Magda is actually the tower. And that's who she was. She was.
And that's where the title of your installation comes from.
So it was this idea that, you know, a woman can have this kind of relationship with politics, and to be like, you know, she was somebody who was a leader at the time, the same time as Jesus.
So. Yeah, because we get this, you know, there are two impressions we get essentially of her and her relationship with the figure of Jesus. One of which is she was his best friend and a great advisor, and that they were politically equal. All of that type of side of it.
Maybe like a political love.
Yeah,
you know.
And then we get the potential love story, but then very quickly Mary Magdalen kind of. It's the fallen woman narrative falls into place very quickly. How quickly did that start, do you think?
I suppose, you know, it starts around the time when her gospel is you know, kind of torn out of the pages. Her pages of her gospel are literally torn away, and she's changed into this kind of composite figure.
We don't have Matthew, Mark, Luke and John and Mary. We just have Matthew, Mark,
exactly,
Luke and John.
Exactly, which is interesting. But I mean, the thing that I find interesting, or that I pursued around it, was the idea that this didn't just happen to Mary Magdalen, but this is a kind of archetype that happens to women through time, which is that their stories or their experiences disappear and they become archetype.
And in the case of Mary Magdalene, as I say, the fallen woman is often
is the
archetype that she's dropped into. I think you started to look at witchery as one of the archetypes, that is another method of dismissing women. And you went back in time, because oftentimes I think when people think of witchcraft, they think of the 16th century and, you know, the famous Salem trials and that period in time, the Puritan era. You went back earlier than that.
Well, I've always been fascinated with the witch trials as like this moment where, I guess, the witch trials are a moment where women, there are roles in society vastly change, and it kind of aligns itself with the rise of like the capitalist system and the nation state. But what I found so interesting for the tower was to think about how before the witch trials, who were the ancestors of the witches and who came before the witches and what set up the conditions for the witch trials, and looking at the heresy trials. And when I start looking at the heresy trials in the 12th century and 13th century, what I found so fascinating was that there were all these incredible women at the end of the 1100s and 12th century that were writing this incredible, deep, complex, mystical, philosophical text and totally psychedelic and trippy, and they were having visions. And these stories like completely disappeared. Like one of the characters, for example, Marguerite Perret, whose text became the heart of my film, The Tower, was executed in 1311 with copies of her book strapped to her body as she was burned to death in the Hotel de Ville. So this idea of how women's histories become debased and archetypal and fallen, for me, is, you know, is also looking at the complexities that arise in this moment of potential.
And what you're and what you present to us in Rua Red then is it's a work that includes film, it includes dance, and it includes text. Just maybe give us a sense of the tower that you've built for us as this installation.
It's a film installation that crosses between a multi-screen video installation with sound and sculptures and live activated performance.
Explain so live activated performances.
There will be a constant performer present in the space for the duration of the film installation. So I try to make this world of expanded cinema in my work. This is the second work in my own trilogy called that began with Tremble Tremble. And this is the second part that tracks back to look at the ancestors of the witches, the mystics. And I hope it's very immersive. For me, it's been a tough time in the last year or 2 years looking at screens and using the phone so much and the screen, where what I'm hoping to achieve in this installation is being embodied with the moving image again and being back in the gallery space with moving image.
And this refers back to what you did with your Venice Biennale piece. It was the same type of form, this expanded cinema, as you talk about. One of the things that is present on the film itself is image and voice, including the voice of Alwyn Fuere.
Yeah.
Let's have a listen to a section here, Stone and Flesh. I think, are these the words of Hildegard von Bingen?
Yeah, this is Hildegard von Bingen.
So
how important, Fuere.
Well, we'll talk about who she was afterwards. Yeah. Let's have a listen to Alwyn Fuere in performance then, and the very strong images present with this sound as well. There of Hildegard von Bingen, as heard in The Tower, a section there called Stone and Flesh, and that featuring the voice of Alwyn Fuere. And Jessie Jones is with me in studio this evening ahead of her installation at the Rua Red called The Tower. Jessie, just to explain the kind of image that we see as we're looking at that, I was very struck by some of it that I saw that you let me see earlier on in the day, which is this idea of, we see Alwyn Fuere's very powerful face on the screen, but her hands are inside her mouth, almost as if she's pulling the words out of her mouth, or perhaps taking, the words are blocked, they're not being allowed out. Just talk to me a little bit about what you were looking at there regarding Hildegard von Bingen.
I suppose there was a kind of sense of thinking about women's voices and the silencing of women. But then also, I really wanted to make something that was just very visceral and strange. And I was really influenced by representations of the Sheila na gCig and this sense of the body as being a portal to another place. So, I mean, a lot of the texts that that you read from the 12th century, from these like early, what could be described as a proto-feminist mystical text of Van Bingen, Magdede Maddeberg and Marguerite Perret. When you read their texts, they're having these very like ecstatic visions. And they're super visceral. They're always about the body. The medieval, in medieval times, people were obsessed with the body. The world of the body was every part of technology. So and the body becomes central.
And when it came to the trials of these women, I think we probably all have images of the 16th century trials, but we maybe don't have the same type of knowledge and images around the 11th and 12th century trials. And again, burnings at the stake. You mean, you mentioned Marguerite Perret with her books tied to her. Mm. I mean, what was who were, I presume it was the church were doing the trials at this stage. And what was the nature of those trials? Was it very similar to the 16th century idea that we have?
It was more related to heresy. So they began as heresy trials. So there was a crisis in the church and they, you know, anybody who spoke differently. And the thing that was very incendiary about these women mystics was, particularly with Perret, was she was writing in plain French. And her, she was writing to the people.
So this was the vernacular. You didn't have to be a scholar to understand it.
You know, so this is a moment where, you know, that just wasn't. And she was saying things like, you know, there should be no shame. Shame is just a manifestation of us not connecting with the God's power, you know. So she, all of her teachings were really anti-establishment. And I feel like that she was definitely identified in relationship to how against power she was. And, you know, Hildegard von Bingen was very embraced by German religious thinkers and because of her music is so beautiful. And, you know, her medical teachings are still alive today. She wasn't a heretic. She was really celebrated in her lifetime.
But in when these women were tried and were then burned at the stake, which was the usual way, either that or drowned to check if you survive, you're a witch, and if you don't survive, well, sorry, but you're gone straight to heaven because you're okay. Were there similar types of, you know, ways of catching up? That there was no winning here. It was a catch 22 situation.
Yeah. Well, I guess it kind of evolved into that absurdity that you're talking about. But when it began as heresy trials, it was connected to actions and public discourse and what you would write and what you would be accused of. But by the time we get to the 16th century, it's like, you know, you made the butter go weird. Like, you know,
it was that ridiculous.
It becomes like, you know, it starts as tragedy and ends in farce, as most things do. But it takes centuries for the witch trials to emerge.
I listen to another little bit of music just as we finish up, and you can tell me a little bit about this afterwards. And that's just some of the music there from the Tower, Jesse Jones' upcoming installation at Rua Red. Just the text and the music that we were listening to there, first of all, Jesse, maybe you'd explain what they were.
The music is by Irene Buckley, an amazing composer who does the score for the film. And I was working with Irene for the last year and a half to develop this. And as I was reading and researching, one book that I was very compelled by was a book called Mary Magdalene, The Left Hand Path of the Feminine Christ. And it's an interesting book, very, you know, theological. But what I really found fascinating by it was this chant, and it stayed in my head, Left Hand Sister. And then I brought it to Irene and she made this beautiful melodic kind of story with it that becomes this repeat refrain between the choir in the film and the call and response between the choir and the figure of Alwyn, who plays this medieval mystic.
So we have that musical element, we have the live performance element, as you said, and there's a certain element of dance and shape making within the images that we see. But it's very easy to look at this and think, oh, well, yes, that was the 11th and 12th centuries, and the other ones were the 16th and 17th centuries. Thanks be to God, we're away from that now. But I'm presuming you want the contemporary viewer to think about this in very contemporary terms. What are you looking for in that respect?
Well, I suppose as an artist, I really use surrealism and archetype in my work to create spaces and feelings that are affecting for people. But my obsession in this work with the connection between the marriage of the church and state and is really about this the particularity of, in Ireland, our relationship to that. If we think about Ireland, the marriage of church and state really only happened for us in the 20th century. So the fallout that we're in is medieval in terms of...
Very recent.
It's in terms of what happened in Europe in the 16th century happened in Ireland in the 1930s. So that's something we have to be really cognizant of, you know, that we're living in the fallout. I mean, one of the things that I remember hearing over and over and over again during the period of time when I was making Tremble Tremble was, we are the great granddaughters of the women you tried to burn, was the chant that women were saying in the UK and Germany. And recently I was realizing that, you know, we are the great granddaughters and granddaughters of the women who would have been or were incarcerated in Magdalen Laundries. My own grandmother was in an industrial school in Golden Bridge. And, you know, the legacies that we live within in our own living memory are so potent and powerful. And in a way, I wanted to point towards that, but in a very effectual and non-narrative way that just kind of touched upon it with feeling rather than storytelling.
Yeah, a lot closer than the 11th or 16th centuries, indeed. Thanks for coming into us this evening, Jessie. That's Jessie Jones. And Jessie's artwork, The Tower, a mixture of live action, film and music, will be launched at Rua Red in Tala, 6 p.m. on Friday, the 27th of May. It continues throughout the summer, through until the 20th of August, in fact. And you can find out full details on the website, which is ruared.ie. Now, you may have heard on the News at One today that the winner of this year's Dublin Literary Award, the largest award in the world for a single novel published in English, is Alice Zeniter for her novel The Art of Losing. Delighted to be joined in studio this evening by Alice and her translator, Frank Wynne, who both share the €100,000 prize. There are so many distinctive things, Alice, about the Dublin Literary Award. Congratulations on winning it, is the first thing I should say,
Thank
of course.
You.
But the nominations for the prize come from libraries all over the world. Inevitably, then, it takes a little bit of time for that to filter its way through to the winning of the award, which you have won today. So this book of yours, The Art of Losing, originally published in France, won the Prix de Goncourt de Lisant in France in 2017. Did you have great expectations from the outset for The Art of Losing?
No. I mean, when I was writing it, I really felt that it was a niche novel. It was almost like a personal travel, because I grew up with almost no stories of the past of my family in Algeria, and why they came to France, and about the first years that they spent in France in the refugee camps. My father only had one sentence, which was, "We spent some time in the south." So, you know, it could have been vacations or even a picnic, but I knew so little that at some point I felt, okay, I want to know more. And my way of knowing, actually, my way of thinking the world, it's writing. I'm not as clever when I just, you know, like when I just think. Writing is my way of understanding what surrounds me.
So in the book, we get we get three generations. We get Ali, who is the grandfather, Hamid, who is the son, and then the granddaughter of Ali, the son or the daughter rather of Hamid, is Naima. So, to what extent should I read Naima, as you, your father and your grandfather in the case of Hamid and Ali, how parallel is your own story to the story that you tell in the book?
My mother had this sentence about Clarisse, which would be her character. And she says, what I like about Clarisse, it's me. What I dislike, it's the fiction. So I guess I'm going to use that.
So the good bits of Naima are all you.
Yeah, no, it's a joke. It's Naima, I really wrote her different from me because I wanted her to not be able to escape her Algerian background. I wanted her to always be caught in the projections that people around her would have. So, you know, I gave her an Arabic name, which is not my case. And I gave her some physical attributes as well that, you know, people would always try I miss one word here.
You wanted to differentiate her from you in some ways, and you did so by making slight differences from how you look even.
Yeah, and to expose her to a constant racism or exoticization that I didn't have to live every day because my name is French and I can pass for a Normandy girl.
Frank Wynne, then, you've been here before, Frank, in terms of Michel Houellebecq, Anatomized in 2002. Great that there's a translator's aspect to this prize as well, isn't it?
It's wonderful. I mean, what I most like about this is it is the only prize which says all books written in English. How they got into English, whether they were written in English or whether they were translated into English, doesn't matter. And it means no longer putting, you know, literature and translation over there as though it's something, you know, difficult and rarefied and only for certain people. Mm. You know, this is, it's a book. You judge it against all other books that happen to be in English in a given year. So it makes a huge difference. And it differentiates it from the prizes which are for people only born in this country or under 35 or over 27 or, you know, or written in X or Y language. This is a very, very inclusive one.
Yeah, I suppose when you go to translate any book, there are always going to be words in another language that just have no equivalent in English. But I'm wondering when you came across the word archi in the case of this book, which is so vital to the story. You might explain the word first of all and tell it why it's so vital to the Algerian French story that Alice is telling.
Well, I came across the word archi in a number of previous books. I've translated a number of novels either by Algerian writers or set in Algeria. After the French colonization of Algeria, France, Algeria became a département, so literally a piece of France. During the Second World War, Algerians and indeed many Moroccans were coerced into fighting, and some enlisted and volunteered to fight with the French in the Second World War, which they did. Having then returned when there was noise about independence and when the terrorist attacks of the FLN began, they were forced to choose sides. On the one hand, groups like the FLN considered them to be traitors already.
Which was the Federate, the Liberating Army in Algeria at the time.
In Algeria at the time. 60s. So they didn't particularly want them, whereas the French, of course, did. And those who were Algerian, who fought with the French and who remained on the side of the French were called Archi. But that also meant that once the War of Independence was over, they had to leave because the newly founded Republic of Algeria considered them to be traitors. As far as they were concerned, every good Algerian man had fought for independence, etc. And unfortunately, this is something that not only followed them into exile, but followed them down the generations. I mean, for many, many Algerians, they would be unable to ever go home. Because their father, grandfather, had been Haki.
And the character of Ali, who is the grandfather character in the book, Ali is one of these archi. How difficult a word is it? How big of a word? How big a label is that word when it's put on somebody? If you like, when somebody is called archi, are they demonized? Is it a very difficult word to handle? A very difficult label to have put on you?
Yes, absolutely. Actually, nowadays it's used by the young generations just to say traitors, cowards, you know, like it's a straight sheer insult.
And this is across, outside of the Algerian context, this is across society, is it? It's just a word that has become
common. Yeah, in France you can use parlance. That. You know, sometimes I hear like young guys in the street and they say that, you know, like, so yeah, it's quite strong. In Algeria it's even worse because they really keep using this word to tell tales. Like it's really... I mean, it gets to crazy dimensions, like you know, like they're talking about the terrorists in the mountains, saying that ISIS, you know, like this is this new branch of terrorists now, and they say like, but you know, they're the sons or grandsons of the Harkis. Like there is only one small group of people who wants to hurt Algeria, and they're all the Harkis from the 50s. So it's quite heavy. And in France, in addition of it being, you know, an insult in the street, it's a word that has been used mostly by the extreme right wing to say that the Harkis were the proof that the colonization of Algeria was a good thing, that indigenous people loved being under French colonization, and that Algeria should have stayed French. So yeah, it's a heavy word to live with,
and a complex word, as all history is, Frank. Yeah. And I suppose you don't have to stretch too far in the imagination to think of the Irish War of Independence and those who fought in the British Army, and the subsequent treatment here. In fact, there are several kind of crossover points between Irish post-colonialism and Algerian post-colonialism. I think
there are a lot of parallels. I mean. As I was saying to Alice earlier, I mean, my father was born in 1901, so he was 15 during the Rising. He would have been in his early 20s when Michael Collins, quote-unquote, betrayed Ireland by agreeing to the Free State. He would have lived through, the Black and Tans and the Civil War and the eventual founding of the Republic. Now, the stories are different, but that attempt to simplify history and say we were on the right side, you were on the wrong side, is very, very close to what Alice is dealing with. The way in which we use history against one another, we try to take multiple histories and fashion them into a national history, which then explains everything and is inviolable, and no one can change a word of it. So yes, I mean, all of the parallels with what had happened in Ireland, but also, I mean, any country which has fought for independence will have had. Yeah. I mean, I've translated a number of novels about the Spanish Civil War, which again, straightforwardly divided, you know, whole families. And so if half of your family was Francoist and the other half was not, that has persisted to this day. And you still get novels like this about how you attempt to repair the multiplicity of stories.
And silence is such a difficult aspect of these stories, Alice. In fact, I think the Algerian War of Independence and the involvement of the Archi therein, it's often referred to as the Silent War.
Yes.
I mean, you couldn't get any part of this from your real life grandfather and father. It was a closed door. It just wasn't spoken about. Is that right?
No, it wasn't. But what is fascinating, you know, with silence is that it's never pure silence. I think, for example, my dad, he wanted his stories to be erased. He wanted to be a white screen, and he wanted to give his daughters no legacy of, you know, no memories of the sufferings, the fear, the pain that the war has been. But it's not true that we got nothing. We got a kind of a whisper, something that they're saying, it's not right that there is no stories. It's a mystery that actually you want to dig in. So the in the end, the silence gets really, really noisy.
Yeah, I was going to say this, the silent scream is often the noisiest one of the whole lot,
yes,
isn't it? And Frank mentioned Michael Collins, the character of Michael Collins, the film of Michael Collins, and there are other aspects of Irish history that are mentioned in the book. How come Irish post-colonial history makes its way into your book? How did that happen?
Because as I said during my my speech earlier today, at the very first shape of the art of losing took place in Ireland, because I was visiting my friend Rob Doyle, and I started telling him about my family stories, and because he knew so few things about Algeria and the War of Independence, I just, you know, I gave him all the information. It was really like, it was a storm, it was way too long, it was messy, and he told me that one day you'll write a book about it, and in exchange he told me about his family stories. And actually he told me that he had one of his grandfather who fought on the British side during the war and was seen as a traitor. And I was like, wait, there is such a thing as an Irish harky. And he was like, well, I don't know what a harky is. And I went, well, I didn't know actually that, you know. Yeah. Somehow the stories of the two countries for me, they got intertwined as the book was starting to appear in my head. So this is why at some point I was like, yeah, I'm going to quote Michael Collins, because he played a part in it, even if he cannot know it.
The title, The Art of Losing, first of all, it's about things that are lost, and obviously, and things that are missing, things that aren't there. But I'm interested in the idea that it's called the art of losing. Is there a way of losing? Is there a way of not having things that is, you know, that has a quality, a positive quality? Because the art of losing suggests there's a good way to lose.
Well, it's a quote from One Art by Elizabeth Bishop, a poem that is about life being a series of losses, and you know, some of them are tiny, like you lose the key of your home, and then you will lose an hour looking for the key. But sometimes you lose the whole house, sometimes you lose a country because you have to go, you can never come back, and of course you lose the memories of your youth, the memories of the gesture of a man you loved. And and through the whole poem she kept saying, the art of losing is not hard to master, but you can feel that it's the opposite. Like, you know, like there is a sweetness and a great sadness in this poem, and I wanted to use it because I think it's way more profound about loss than the idea of losing a war, which comes like, you know, the big loss with trumpets and broken weapons and all of that. This, it's a small river of losses.
The other thing that is important here, the archy, you know, the idea of an archy traveling back to Algeria is quite frightening, I would think, possibly still to this very day. But we get in the book this idea that perhaps a generation or two down, that journey can be made. Have you made the trip to Algeria?
Yes.
And how was that?
It was basically, it looks a lot like a Naima's travel, which means that I arrived on top of the mountains not knowing if I would be welcomed or not, if I would be considered family, you know, or if I would be in danger, if my family name would put me in danger. And then, I finally found the village, and everyone had my family name, more or less, so it wouldn't put me in danger at all. And then... So I entered a small shop and I said that I was Zeniter, and the boy at the counter said, well, I'm Zeniter too. Then he called his dad, who would speak a bit of French, and the dad drove me to his home. And when we arrived there, a little girl ran in our direction, and she looked exactly like my cousin. She had, you know, like perfectly the same face. Yeah. And so suddenly that was this weird biology thing that, you know, that this face was replicated on the other side of the sea. And with a 10 years gap, and I was moved to tears.
I can imagine that. One final question. What about France under Macron? The wrong done to Algerians, is that being addressed?
I'm sorry, what?
France under President Macron.
Yeah.
Is the wrong that was done to Algeria and Algerians, has that been addressed in any way in contemporary France?
Yes, it has. It has. But in the same time, they're playing a really dirty game, I think, because they are willing to address the wrongdoings that were from 60 years ago, but in the same time, they are using more and more of the racist speech that used to be only the extreme right-wing speech. So they're kind of, we recognize the problem from the past, but we are actually doing the same mistakes and targeting the Arabic population right now. So, I'm not sure it's a big progress.
Yeah. Well, listen, lovely to have spoken with you. Congratulations on the award. I know there's a big celebratory dinner, and that's where you need to go. Go to now and enjoy your evening very much. That's Ali Zeniter, the author of The Art is Losing, and Frank Wynne, the translator of self-same novel published by Picador, and that novel, and Alice and Frank, the winners of today's Dublin Literary Award. Congratulations to you both. The death was announced today of the much-loved Irish travel writer Dervla Murphy. She was 90 years old, based in the Waterford town of Lismore, and over the course of her decades-long career wrote more than 25 books about her travels around the globe by bicycle, by foot, by mule and by public transport. Born in County Waterford in 1931, she was the only child of her parents, Fergus and Kathleen, who were Dubliners themselves. She always returned to her hometown of Lismore after her journeys, saying that she wouldn't live anywhere else. 1965 saw the publication of Full Tilt, Ireland to India with a Bicycle, which chronicled her 6 months travelling through Europe, Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, over the Himalayas and into Pakistan and India. She won many awards for her work, including last year the Edward Stanford Award for Outstanding Contributions to Travel Writing. In an interview with broadcaster John Quinn, Dervla explained the pivotal 10th birthday she had when she received a bicycle from her parents and an atlas from her beloved grandfather, and decided there and then she wanted to travel to India.
I can remember the exact spot on the road where I decided that that's what I would do one day.
And you did.
Why India? Was there a particular...
Well, having consulted this atlas, which coincided with the bicycle, I discovered that there was almost no water between Ireland and India. So that was really, there was no more convoluted reason than that for the original decision. But then, having made that decision, I became very interested in India.
Dervla had one daughter, Rachel, and in 1979, in an interview on Women Today with Marion Finucane, she talked about taking Rachel travelling with her for the first time.
When she was just coming up to five, she had her fifth birthday in India. That was her first long trip.
And how did she take it at that time?
Oh, splendidly, no problems. Of course, it was a trip that had to be tailored to a five-year-old. It wasn't a normal sort of expedition. On that occasion, we travelled mainly by little local buses, and we lived for 2 months in a village in the jungle in Coorg not to over-travel her, as you might say.
And how did she travel in the next trips that you did?
She rode a pony in Baltistan. And in Peru, our original plan was that she would ride a mule from Cajamarca to Cusco. But in fact, it was so difficult to get fodder for the mule that she could only ride the first 600 miles and she walked the next 900.
At what age?
10. Well, 9, 10. She had her 10th birthday there.
All that travelling that you and Rachel have done together must have led to a very, very, very close relationship, a mother-daughter relationship.
Well, yes, I suppose it has. But also at the end of a long journey, we're very glad to get rid of each other. And for instance, when we came back from South America, Rachel went off to stay with friends in England and I went off to stay with quite other friends as far away as possible from where she was.
Never one to mince her words, either in an interview or in her writing. That's the travel writer, Dervla Murphy, there speaking to Marion Finucane in 1979. And Dervla Murphy has died at the age of 90. Russian composer Igor Stravinsky, perhaps best known for The Rite of Spring, a work so shocking that it provoked riots during its premiere in Paris in 1913. 5 years later came a ditty called The Soldier's Tale, Faustian music theatre fable, in which a soldier sells his violin to the devil for limitless riches. Based on an old Russian folktale, the musical version of it is written for seven musicians, three actors and a dancer. Ciarán Hinds plays all three roles of the narrator, soldier and devil in a production about to open at Dublin's Smock Alley Theatre on the 31st of May. The Fuse Ensemble provide the music and dancer. Emily Ayres is the princess. Violinist Joanne Quigley McParland also directs, and she is the violinist. She's with me in studio now. It's a great little... I call it a ditty. It's unfair to call it that, but it's a real curiosity piece, this, when you think of Stravinsky and the huge works that he made at other times in his career, Joanne.
Yes, it is, and indeed. And I suppose the piece was born out of necessity because for an economical reason, he needed to feed his four children, and he had a sick wife at the time and was just coming out of war and was in exile in Switzerland. And he and his pal, Charles Ferdinand Ramus, the writer, cooked up this plan to produce a small-scale touring theatre, music theatre piece, and that they were going to bring it around all these small, local, rustic theatres around Switzerland and make their living, because, of course, all his royalties had dried up at that point, and he was a bit strapped. So it is a curious piece, but it's pure Stravinsky as well.
And the other thing about it is, if we think of the period of time, the historical period in which it's written, we're just at the kind of the birth of jazz, and Shostakovich was doing this as well, kind of taking jazz themes and jazz idioms and working them into classical music, wasn't he?
Absolutely. And Stravinsky in this piece, there's lots of dance elements. So we have Emily, who's choreographed this fantastic dance sequence at the end of the show. But he uses tango and ragtime, which he was aware of and influenced by at the time, and a very quirky waltz, which is full of little acerbic Stravinsky ideas there as well.
And you wouldn't want to be trying to count a nice straightforward 1-2-3 to a Stravinsky waltz.
No.
Let's have a listen to a little section of the music from The Soldier's Tale. That's just a little section of the tango. It moves all into a waltz and a ragtime further into the piece there. Joanne Quigley McParland with me in studio this evening, talking about this upcoming production of Stravinsky's The Soldier's Tale, with Ciarán Hinds in the role of narrator. And there's quite a lot, we were just saying as we were listening to the music there, John, there's quite a lot for the narrator to do, because he's effectively narrating and he's playing the devil and he's playing the soldier.
Yes, so he has to move between characters really slickly in this piece, and he does it fantastically. We've done it a couple of times. We played at Kilkenny Festival in 2019, and our first run was in the north, in the Mac and the Heaney home place, and in Warren Point in 2018. So that was a bit of an experiment to see if we could make it work with just one actor. And you need somebody very versatile to be able to take that on. So
it was an accidental meeting, I think, in this very building that actually started this all off.
In 2011, I was the acting leader of the concert orchestra for a year. And during one rehearsal, I was asked if I would mind stepping out and coming to play for Miriam O'Callaghan's show. And it was for Ciarán and his sister, Brona. And they had no idea that there was going to be a live violinist. They had chosen this one combined piece, which was the Cúlainn, which was very special to them. So we met then and we stayed in touch, and once or twice actually bumped into each other at airports as we were, he was going somewhere and I was touring somewhere. And I sort of tentatively asked him if he might be interested in this as an idea, and we managed to get it together for 2018.
So. It's grown from there. One of the things that's interesting about the text in it for me is that the devil essentially is wants the violin, which is the man's soul, suppose, in some ways, if you want to put it that way. And he hands over a book that kind of tells things ahead of time. Insider trading, I think, would be a term for it. It's very much, in other words, he will know if you buy these shares, they're going to go up.
Absolutely.
It's very much an anti-capitalist text here, isn't it, from Stravinsky?
Yes. you know, I think that the text is really clever. We're actually using a translation, a more modern translation by Jeremy Sams, and Ciarán puts his own little spin on it as well. So we don't have any set in this piece, you know. So I think actually there's a footnote in the score which says it's to be read, played and danced, and we're actually just doing that. So it's we've got some lighting, very clever lighting by our lighting designer Owen McCartan as well. There's so much in the text and the music to keep everybody interested, I think, for the hour.
And tell me a little bit about the Fuse Ensemble, because you are the one with your brother, I think, founder member of the Fuse Ensemble. You play violin, your brother David plays piano, and those are two of the instruments that are involved here. Are the other members here part of the Fuse Ensemble as well?
Well, because of the slightly odd instrumentation of the Soldier's Tale, you know, he pairs treble and bass instruments from each family: violin, double bass, clarinet, bassoon, trumpet, trombone and percussion. The Fuse Ensemble is essentially a string group with piano and clarinet. So we do have a few of our members, but
we call other experts in to get the bigger bass instruments, the bass side of things. Well, listen, that's Joanne Quigley McParland telling us about The Soldier's Tale at Smock Alley Theatre in Dublin, 31st of May through until the 4th of June. SmockAlley.com for full details.